The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today we'll be talking about the science that influences the healthcare decisions parents make for their children and women make for themselves. A little later on, we'll talk to skeptical activist Rebecca Watson about pseudoscience that's targeted and marketed to women. But first, I'm joined by the authors of Your Baby's Best Shot, Why Vaccines Are Safe and Save Lives. First, we have Stacey Herlihy, professional reader and educational assessment specialist. Welcome, Stacey.
Hi.
And also joining us is E. Allison Haygood. Before she became a psychology professor, she was a clinician and researcher specializing in adults with severe mental illnesses. Allison, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Now, anyone following these sorts of things knows that there are an absolute plethora of books on vaccination, but yours takes a bit of a new angle on it. Tell us about that.
Stacey and I felt that most of the books out there were coming from a point of view of professionals in the field, whether those professionals were nurses or doctors. We felt that the combination of our particular expertise, me being an educator and her being a parent and a professional writer, would fill a gap that the current books left in the market.
This is an extremely accessible read, but it's also very thorough. How did you research it?
Well, we've been working on it for years. We've been researching this issue. I personally became interested in it when I first got pregnant way back in 2002. What I think you see is this sort of need for what is a basic public health measure, but I think sometimes that gets drowned out in voices of parents who sometimes, I think, don't necessarily have access to good information.
One thing that I very much liked about this book, there is not an ounce of condescension in it. So thank you for that.
We really wanted to address concerns, legitimate concerns. There are parents out there who are receiving some very bad information from some very biased sources, and it's understandable that parents are going to run across this information and be quite concerned, especially with the way the information is presented. And it was important for us to address those concerns with compassion and also be able to present some relatively technical scientific information in a way that parents could understand it. And, you know, having been an educator now for more than a decade and having all of my classes involve that, presenting technical information in an understandable way, I felt that that was what I brought to the book, the expertise of being an educator. And then Stacey's expertise is coming from the point of view of the compassionate parent.
So you started off this book talking not about vaccines themselves, but the cognitive biases that actually we all have. So maybe tell us a bit about them.
One of the things that I try to do with all of my students, and I sort of thought about the readers of this book almost as students in my classes, and I don't mean that disrespectfully at all, because I do have a lot of non-traditional students, but a lot of times I think people in general feel that their thought processes are completely objective. And there's such an enormous amount of information in the field of cognitive psychology and the field of information processing about the ways that we fool ourselves into thinking that we're objective when we're not. And I knew that in all of the discussions I've had over the years with about this issue and all of the discussions either face-to-face or online that I've had about a lot of issues, people have a tendency to trust their own thought process more than they probably should. So it was important for me to kind of start out with an idea to the reader of, I know what you're thinking. Here's why you're thinking the way you are. Not in a disrespectful way again, but it just in a, we all process information badly. We're, you know, loath to look for information that tells us we're wrong. We notice and pick out information that tells us we're right. So parents who have a pre-existing opinion about an issue as important as vaccines, when they do what we do these days, which is, you know, all information is on the net, and we go and do a Google search, we will naturally pick out information that fits with what we already believe. And it's very difficult, therefore, for a lot of us to force ourselves into an information gathering mindset where we deliberately seek out information that we might not like. And so I wanted to introduce that idea at the very beginning so that parents might recognize that process in themselves.
Well, you also you brought up the concept of illusory correlation, which I think is really valuable here.
Yes, and that's one of the favorite things I love to talk about. You know, superstitions or illusory correlations. We're in football season these days, and people think that watching football, wearing a certain jersey or a certain T-shirt is going to give their team more winning power. And we notice information that confirms that belief, even when there's no relationship there. And it's in this particular issue, it's very easy to do. Parents who have their child receive a vaccination and then the child experience something, whether it's a high fever or a sore arm or a crying fit, will naturally relate that behavior to a memorable event like a vaccination. And they'll build a belief that those two things are related to each other. And they'll not notice the times when maybe their child has a fever with no vaccination that precedes it, or when their child receives a vaccination and doesn't have a reaction. We notice things that are vivid and memorable. It's very difficult for us to process sort of our boring everyday lives. And so things have to kind of stick out in our minds in order for us to remember them. And then when they do, we put them together. We have pattern recognition tendencies that are worthwhile in many, many, many cases, but sometimes they lead us astray.
And those biases actually become even more of an issue when they're emotional stories, aren't they?
Completely. Emotion versus logic. I don't want to use the kind of false dichotomy that they fight with each other, but certainly we tend to be drawn to emotional information. We like stories. We like feeling good or bad about something. And numbers are boring. Numbers are, when I tell my students about statistics, I can just see them sort of glaze over. And I tease them, of course, about being frightened of numbers because we're Americans, and Americans have a tendency to be frightened of numbers. But so a story that a parent tells about this is what happened and I was very worried is going to override the 1 out of 4 million, blah, blah, blah. And so, yes, emotion draws us to information much more so than numbers do.
So how have those kind of inherent biases affected the perception of vaccines?
We do not have in most of the living memory, obviously the older generation does, but the younger generations do not have living memory of watching large numbers of their classmates or their children suffer from and die from vaccine-preventable diseases. So when we have a lack of disease in sort of the epidemiology, a lack of suffering, when suffering occurs, it's much more easy to notice, and it's much easier to be emotionally attached to that without being able to put it in the context of no longer are people having to worry about dying of measles or becoming deaf from measles or having their fetuses exposed to rubella and then developing congenital rubella syndrome. It's harder to emotionally connect with a lack or an absence of something. And so when you have parents who truly believe that their children have had a vaccine reaction, they notice their child crying, their child having a fever, their child having an achy arm, and they don't notice the not dying or the not suffering part.
When you read history, it almost becomes a history of mothers mourning children and being, you know, shocked at having a baby, and then the baby dies of pertussis 3 months later, or measles sweeps through the community. And it's heartbreaking to read this stuff because it's so common and it's so constant. They lived with little babies dying back then, and, you know, and thankfully we don't do that today. And I think people are a little removed from that, and that's great and it's wonderful, but it pushes you away from actually having that firsthand knowledge that Allison talked about.
for example, in my family, I had, while I was growing up as a child, we had an older cousin who had survived polio. And so we were all very much aware that this was within living memory an issue. I think one of the concerns I have when I interact with people about this issue is that they focus on the dying. They focus on, well, not everyone with measles dies, or not everyone who got pertussis died back then. And while that's true, vaccine preventable diseases don't kill 100% of people who get them, there is also an issue of a reduction of suffering. You know, if your child lives through pertussis, that's fantastic. But there's a vaccine that would have prevented that suffering in the first place. And so I don't understand a lot of times why the discussion gets focused on death, on the deaths from the diseases, although that is an absolutely important aspect of the discussion. We sometimes forget that the vaccines also reduce suffering. And that in and of itself, I think, is a hugely valuable contribution to public health.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Allison Haygood and Stacey Herlihy, the authors of Your Baby's Best Shot. So we're talking about a lot of different things here. Let's talk about perception of vaccines. How did people see them when vaccines were being first rolled out for smallpox?
That's part of what I dealt with in the book. I mean, I majored in history and I've taught social studies, and there was sort of almost a dichotomy in some ways. On one hand, people were incredibly grateful at the prospect of having something to fight smallpox because they were terrified of it. One of my favorite things in researching this book was finding out that Thomas Jefferson, our president, learned to give the vaccine for smallpox. And on the other hand, they were kind of scared. People were a little bit afraid of the vaccine itself. When it came out, the smallpox vaccine itself wasn't particularly refined. It could have horrible side effects. You know, they were afraid it wouldn't work. They were afraid they would catch smallpox from the vaccine. I mean, you see some parallels today between parents back then who said, I do not want to vaccinate my child against smallpox, and parents today who say, I don't want to vaccinate my child against pertussis. People were genuinely afraid.
There's always been an anti-vaccine movement as long as there have been vaccines.
Right.
So it's not a new phenomenon. I think one of the issues that makes it more problematic these days is the technology that's allowing us to have this conversation. If you have the internet and you have 24/7 access to millions of pieces of information, then you can spread a lot of problematic information very quickly.
Now, this is one of the issues that I was wondering about. So how were people convinced at that point that vaccines were a good idea? Was it just the fact that 30% of people who contracted smallpox died from it?
It was a combination of things. There were laws that did kind of sort of almost make it mandatory. Yeah, it was also a terrifying fear because it wasn't, if you survived smallpox, you could still wind up with these horrible scabs on your face. It was a disfiguring disease. It could get into your eyes and blind you. You know, people were very desperate and they wanted a cure. They wanted a prevention.
I do think that having the experience of seeing someone that you love suffer or die made people certainly more likely to accept the necessity of vaccines in general. I'm always sort of astonished at the people who say, well, I had chickenpox growing up and I didn't die, and therefore the chickenpox vaccine isn't necessary. And nobody I know died back when I was a child. And the reason for that, obviously, is that we have these wonderful disease prevention devices that are preventing people from having that personal experience. I do believe that probably throughout the course of history, there was always a small percentage of people who could not be convinced, who could not see, did not accept the importance of vaccinations. We're obviously seeing that today. And so it's always been a challenge. I think it's a more of a challenge now because of the widespread nature of misinformation.
I do want to speak to parents because I do understand. My daughter, my eldest, she had a vaccine reaction, and I talk about this briefly in the book. 2 months old, high-pitched, horrible screaming, and it was terrifying. And one of the things that I sort of, and Allison and I hope to get across in the book, is your child can have a vaccine reaction, and you know what? It's okay. You know, she's fine, my eldest. It's understandable, though. And what happens is right now you get on the net and you're like, vaccine reaction, oh no. And some of these sites that are purveying this information that's unfortunately wrong look very convincing. I know, I was researching the book You know, Google unfortunately sometimes gives these websites a little bit of a higher ranking than I feel they deserve. So it's very easy to get access to wrong information on this issue if you're a parent. And one of the things that I kind of wanted to do in this book, and I hope we succeeded, is in helping to demolish what you might have heard, some of the more modern myths.
Well, actually, let's talk about that, because that was one of the things I'm wondering about, the issue of hygiene. Can we attribute a lot of the lessening of vaccine-preventable illnesses to just improved hygiene in places? Because that is something that gets mentioned by people who are concerned about vaccinations, that it wasn't really the vaccine that eradicated these kinds of diseases.
Certainly, improved hygiene was found and has been found to with a reduction of disease overall. But to remove vaccination from that equation is not a statistically valid approach. We certainly don't deny that improved hygiene, improved medical interventions, improved medical understanding has had a hand in reducing vaccine-preventable diseases. But it is not statistically valid to say that it was 100% of hygiene and the vaccines have done nothing. And that's kind of the black and white thinking that we tend to encounter when we have conversations with people about this issue. It's sort of an all or nothing thing. It's either the hygiene or nothing, or it's just the vaccines and nothing else. Vaccines are a critical part of public health intervention to reduce vaccine-preventable diseases.
We have a question from Foster.
Is there any particular vaccine that is the most important in terms of preventing infant mortality?
I believe that would depend on the location of the infant. Vaccine-preventable diseases in one country, the epidemiology of them is going to be different than in other countries of the world. That's one of the reasons why smallpox was addressed first, because it was the one at the time that was the one that was killing the most people. And then, of course, polio was next. And so that's one of those questions that's going to be difficult to answer, because it's going to depend on a lot of different factors. It's also going to depend on whether the child has a susceptibility to a particular illness, or whether the child is diagnosed as having some sort of condition that requires that they be cocooned and that everyone around them receive a certain vaccine because they can't for whatever legitimate medical reason. And so I don't think that there's going to be an easy answer to that question, unfortunately.
Well, I will say also, as a parent, there are two diseases that kind of scare me, I think. Measles. Measles, what scares me about it is it's so contagious. I've seen quotes anywhere upwards of 90%. You're not vaccinated, you will get it. And you cannot give the MMR, the measles, mumps, rubella, to a baby under a year, I think, is the current recommendation right now. So anything that you can to reduce measles. Another one for me would be the pertussis vaccine, otherwise known as, I think it's called the DTaP. Pertussis is very scary in little babies. You're talking approximately a 1 in 250 rate of death. You know, those for me would be extremely important vaccines.
Oh, and I agree with Stacey 100%. And the reason why I think for Stacey and for people in America, to use us as an example, that those are more concerning is that polio is not endemic in America the way it is in other countries. And that's why I said that we can't really provide an answer of what's the most important, because it's going to depend. Certainly in America, I would agree with Stacey, especially with the pertussis. We've got an outbreak here in Boulder. There's a huge epidemic in Washington State, and that is a problematic condition.
And we'll be right back to talk more with Allison Haygood and Stacey Herlihy, the authors of Your Baby's Best Shot, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and my guests this episode are Stacey Herlihy and Allison Haygood, and they're the authors of Your Baby's Best Shot, Why Vaccines Are Safe and Save Lives. You know, we're sort of skirting a lot of the issue that certain people that are concerned about vaccinations have, and that's how do they work physiologically. So tell me that first.
Basically, what vaccines are doing is inducing your immune system to create a reaction to what's known as an antigen. And an antigen is sort of anything that stimulates the immune system. And what you're getting is basically a very, very weakened form or even a dead form of a particular illness. And the body will mount an immune response. And what that does is it means you don't actually have to get the disease. I mean, that's basically it, you know, just from a layperson's standpoint of view.
One of the amazing things about vaccines is that they don't even require a full virus, full bacteria. One, like the example that pertussis vaccine we're using today, uses bits of the bacteria and not the full bacteria. So that's one of the reasons why vaccines are safer than the disease, is that because the amount of disease material that you are exposed to is less than an actual wild version, the immune response can handle that much better. But then the antibodies that are created will be just as effective at fighting off a wild virus strain. So it's just an overall an amazing medical technology that allows us to reduce death and also, like I said before, to reduce suffering.
Now, how does herd immunity work then?
Herd immunity is the concept that not every single person in a particular area needs to be vaccinated for everyone to be protected from vaccine-preventable diseases. Certainly, one of the things that we do talk about and one of the things that we want to recognize and want to discuss is that there are some people who cannot, for legitimate reasons, receive a vaccine. Children or adults who, for example, are immunocompromised, transplant recipients, children under a certain age, or for whatever reason, have some legitimate medical reasons why they cannot receive a vaccination. There are some people, I have a friend, for example, who does not create antibodies to pertussis and has had pertussis several times in her life because her body does not create those antibodies. And that does happen. Some vaccinations are not effective for everybody. And so what that means is that as long as a certain percentage of the population has received a vaccination and had a good reaction to it, then those people who cannot receive a vaccination or who don't respond to a vaccination will still be protected. And the unfortunate aspect in American society these days is that there are quite a few areas where we've gone below the minimum percentage required to provide herd immunity.
Basically, also, the virus or the disease will not be able to get a new host. So if you have it and everybody else around you was vaccinated, the virus is not going to be able to go anyplace else because you have this herd immunity going on. So somebody who's not around you will not be able to get the disease. You won't be able to pass it on. The herd is really sort of a fence. And the other issue sometimes is for different viruses, it can be different levels of herd immunity. You know, you need to get a certain percentage vaccinated where they think the wall of protection is, depending on the disease.
Right.
Right now, my understanding is approximately 90% of all Americans are vaccinated. But what we sometimes see, unfortunately, is approximately 60% of all parents will delay a vaccine or not give the full series. And I think there's a little bit of a misconception out there just getting into that, in that delaying does not help. Parents are delaying for a lot of reasons, but primarily because they're mostly afraid of a vaccine reaction. And in our book, we talk about studies that indicate that delaying does not reduce the prospect of a vaccine reaction. What it does is really just leave your child more vulnerable for a longer period.
And here's where we get into those very specific concerns that a lot of parents have. One of them is with the ingredients of vaccines. So what's in them?
It depends on the specific vaccines, but what you have sort of are basically the virus itself in a killed form or a chopped up piece of form, and then various other minor amounts of ingredients. There's an ingredient adjuvant that is intended to help increase the efficacy of the vaccines. There are also other minute amounts of chemicals that may help increase the storage of a vaccine over a prolonged period, and other chemicals that also may reduce the effect, the possibility of the vaccine going bad. You know, it's sort of, to me, we use the analogy of a tuna fish sandwich. You know, if you looked at the ingredients in a tuna fish sandwich, you'd be like, oh my God, you're kidding me. You'd never touch a tuna fish sandwich again. But this material that kind of looks very scary on initial reading really isn't. For example, yeah, there's a little bit of formaldehyde in some of the vaccines. The thing is, A, it's a very, very small quantity, and B, your own body makes formaldehyde. It's a byproduct of your body's processes.
The issue, of course, is one that we come back to a lot. It's an idea that the dose makes the poison.
Right.
To use the formaldehyde example that Stacey brought up, which, like she correctly said, is a byproduct, natural byproduct of our metabolism. You know, people know that formaldehyde is an embalming fluid and that it's labeled as a carcinogen by the FDA and their OSHA standards of storing it. And what they don't realize is that a gallon of formaldehyde is a very different concept than a microgram of formaldehyde. And that the idea is there these tiny, tiny amounts of these chemicals that all serve a purpose. They're not in there for kicks. They actually are there for a purpose. Are of such low quantity that massive amounts of the guidelines of storage and safety for massive amounts of them just can't apply to something that's smaller than a grain of sand. But it's sort of that black and white thinking again, is that if it's dangerous in at any concentration, it's dangerous all the time. And so it's difficult sometimes to address those fears when people can't visualize just how tiny the amounts of these ingredients are.
And now, how do we know all this exactly, though? How are vaccines tested?
The development of vaccines is something that is a very long process. I think that there is a myth that parents have that vaccines are just whipped up in a lab and hit the market the next day. Any new vaccine that's introduced into the population has to pass through a number of levels, a number of phases of clinical trials. First, they have to be proven to have ingredients that are safe, have been proven to be safe in other vaccines or in other medicines that are used on, that are on the market. Then they have to go to animal testing to make sure that they don't cause the animal to grow a third eye or in some way, you know, have some sort of very severe effect on a living organism. And all of these tests take a number of years. And there are a number of, it's going to depend on obviously who's doing the developing and under what country they're developing their product, because the FDA has requirements that other countries may or may not have. And so by the time it makes it to clinical trials for humans, it's already gone through a number of phases of testing for safety and for efficacy in non-human models. And then it is marketed through hopefully a series, and of course when I say hopefully I'm being sarcastic because the FDA wouldn't allow anything on the market that didn't go through these, a series of clinical trials in which it is presented to people for testing and for efficacy issues. Does it actually work? Is it creating the response we want? And only then, if it's proven to be safer and more effective than a placebo, is it allowed to be marketed. And, you know, I kind of read up on the vaccine developments that are going on right now, and there are a huge number of attempted vaccines that never make it past phase one or phase two, much less phase three, either because it's not effective, not as effective as it could be, not effective in comparison to the side effect profile. And so that sort of in a nutshell is some of the issues that have to do with vaccine testing. But they are tested in a series of clinical trials for safety and for efficacy. And those clinical trials are available to the public through PubMed or some of the other more specialized search engines that are out there, like Google Scholar or Academic One Search Premier, which is a specialized academic search. And so it's not like there's this hidden information about vaccine safety and efficacy. It's definitely available.
But we don't want to present it that there are no possible side effects to vaccines, because there definitely are.
Completely. And that is another thing that we do address in the book. There are legitimate reactions. The vast majority of the reactions are minor, mild side effects like an achy arm or a fever. Mild fever after a vaccine is actually a pretty common reaction. And it's actually a pretty common good reaction. It means that the immune system is kicking in and creating the response that was wanted. You know, some children may be cranky because they don't feel good for a couple of days. It depends, obviously, on the vaccine. Certain vaccines are going to be more likely to have reactions than other vaccines because of the type of virus in the vaccine, whether it's what's called a live attenuated or weakened version or a killed version or one that uses just bits of the protein of the disease pathogen.
Well, so what's the worst case scenario for vaccinations?
It is possible that a child could have encephalitis. There are, I think, the statistics for the possibility of encephalitis for the measles vaccine is about 1 in 1 million vaccine doses. To put that in perspective, the chance of encephalitis from the measles disease itself is about 1 in 1,000. So certainly we don't want to deny that severe vaccine reactions can take place, but the likelihood of that is significantly less than the likelihood of a severe reaction from the disease itself.
And right. Especially with some of these diseases being so epidemic right now, you know, pertussis just scares me. The Chinese called it the 100-day cough. You can cough so badly, you'll break a rib, even if you're an adult.
And that's one of the problems, is that even knowing that the risk is almost infinitesimal, it's difficult to go into that knowingly.
It's scary. I mean, I sat there with my babies and going, oh my God, it's a needle. You know, your brain just gets very primitive and very scared. And I understand as a parent, I really do. But, you know, you just have to do it in most cases because it's your child's best protection. It really is.
And that gets, again, to my earlier statement where I stated that one of the things that we focus on is the vaccine preventable disease deaths. And why are we not also thinking that the reduction of suffering is a good thing? The children who don't have to spend, you know, several weeks with a cough or maybe several months with a cough that they live through, but there's still all of this suffering that that has to take place. We have this idea that if it doesn't kill you, then that's a good thing. But if it doesn't kill you, but it makes you suffer for a while, then why don't we get rid of that as well?
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Stacey Herlihy and Allison Haygood, the authors of Your Baby's Best Shot, Why Vaccines Are Safe and Save Lives. So we're almost out of time, but I do want to get to one thing, and that would be autism. I don't want to spend too much time on it, though, because honestly, the idea of a connection between vaccines and autism has been so thoroughly and so spectacularly debunked, and it's also been covered very well in many, many other places. Paul Offit, the gentleman who wrote the foreword to your book, is a pediatrician specializing in infectious diseases, and he's also an expert on vaccines, and he wrote what is really the definitive book on this. That was Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure. But that said, I guess we have to do a brief rundown on where people got the idea that there was a link in the first place, because people still think that sometimes.
It started in 1998. There was a study published in The Lancet, the British medical journal, The Lancet. That was a study of 12, I want to repeat that, 12 children. Such a small study is called a pilot study, generally. Investigators will use a small number of children to investigate experimental model before they use it on larger numbers of children, or they'll investigate a question in a small number of children in order to see if it's worth investigating in a larger number of children. So the issue is that this study that was published included 12 children who were not randomly selected. Random selection, random sampling is what it's called, is a key aspect of valid scientific research. And so you can't just choose people that you think should be included in your study. You have to choose, you have to sort of roll a dice and get as many people as possible who are randomly chosen to participate. Again, early studies, small studies like this, don't rely on random sampling because they are focused on a particular question. So it was determined through this study. And the interesting thing for me is that the original study, this is the infamous Wakefield study. The study specifically states in the conclusion and discussion section that a link between vaccines and autism was not found. And this is the original study that everyone refers to as starting the myth that vaccines cause autism. And in the actual study itself, it specifically states we did not find a link between the MMR vaccine, which is the one in particular that was being looked at, and the pervasive developmental disorders in the children we studied. They go on to say this needs further study. And as someone who used to do research and who teaches research, I agree. Certainly with a small sample size like that, we should do more research. And then we have, and have found no link. But what was interesting is that the lead author of that study, Andrew Wakefield, in a press conference the day before it was released, went to the press and stated that, in his opinion, the MMR was too dangerous to continue to give because it was linked to autism. So the press sort of picked that up without apparently reading the actual study that said there was no link and sort of ran with it. And so 14 years later, here we are, and the study was retracted, which in scientific publishing terms is a pretty severe statement that it should never have been published in the first place. There were a number of conflicts of interest that were not revealed. And it's interesting for me as someone who understands cognitive psychology issues that the more information that we present about how badly the study was done, the less people believe that it was a bad study. It's almost as if it's called reactance. They're digging their heels in on this study. And then, like I said, we've done dozens of studies since this one was published with lots more people, lots more subjects, and they've found no link. But that I refer to that study sometimes as the study that will not die, because
indeed,
because as you pointed out, it's been debunked
spectacularly.
No better word than that. I don't really, and obviously, Wakefield is still considered someone who is legitimate and valid in certain movements. And it's very frustrating for me as a person who tries to teach critical thinking skills and rational thinking to my students when I engage in sort of the same conversations about how the response with a certain subgroup of people is yes, but.
And we have a question from the chat from Insider.
What would you think about trying to rename or rebrand vaccines as immune boosters or something else that sounds less intimidating?
Oh, that's so clever.
I thought so.
That's very clever. I'm impressed.
It certainly may be something, marketing them better. It certainly may be something that, because in the alternative medical community, the idea of immune system boosters, take this herb and you'll boost your immune system. Well, certainly we could tap into that. I'm not 100% sure I could be convinced, simply because I'm not a big fan of manipulative language. But certainly addressing the fears, I think that's part of the approach. What exactly is it that parents are fearful of when they hear the word vaccine? And that really was the impetus for the book. What are the fears? Let's dig them out and root them out and pick them apart.
Allison, Stacy, we are out of time, but thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
You'll find links to E. Allison Haygood and Stacy Herlihy and their book, Your Baby's Best Shot, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Rebecca Watson to discuss women's intuition and other fairy tales after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll spend the hour talking about genetically modified foods that are causing conversation among scientists, lawmakers, and the public. Horticulture professor Kevin Folta returns to the show, along with Carl Harrow von Mogel and Anastasia Bodnar, co-editors of biofortified.org. They'll give us the scientific perspective on the benefits and possible dangers of genetically manipulating common food crops. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Rebecca Watson, founder of the skeptic.org blog network and podcaster on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. Wonderful to have you here, Rebecca.
Hi, good to be here.
So you came to Edmonton a few weeks ago to do a presentation on women's intuition and other fairy tales, and it was great. But you spoke about some specific products that are aimed directly at women and ones specifically that don't seem to have much evidence to back them up. So I'm just wondering if we could go over a few of those that you mentioned.
Sure. Douche is my favorite to talk about.
Thank you.
Douche is a product that is not only completely useless for most women, but is actively harmful to women. And a lot of people don't know about that. Douche is something that basically just firebombs your vagina. It's vinegar and water, usually, or at least that's classic douche. And what it does is it clears out all the good bacteria in a woman's vagina, which allows infection to take hold, which can lead to a whole host of horrific diseases that could that include things that could lead to sterility and other problems. A lot of people don't even realize that the vagina is a self-cleaning thing. You don't need douche, but that is not what commercials and advertisements have been telling women for 60, 70 years now. We can look back and see Lysol ads, because that's what Lysol originally was sold as a douche. And we can see these ads that are telling women, you know, that their husbands will leave them and, you know, or just not love them anymore if they don't douche. It's the classic advertiser trick of making up something that's wrong with you and then selling you a product to fix it. And something that's done quite often, particularly for women. So yeah, it's a product that is actively harmful, but it's not something that I saw skeptics addressing very often, well, at all. Despite the fact that skeptics tend to be interested in investigating products, you know, that use pseudoscience to be sold to hapless victims. That's exactly what douche is, but nobody was really talking about it. So I like to open most of my talks with a little rant about douche.
I think that works well. I'm just wondering, why do you think that the douche is still being marketed? Because it is, as you say, actively harmful. So, you know, you can think about in the 50s, fine, douche with Lysol or your husband won't love you. But haven't we moved past that, especially with a product that's actively harmful?
In the U.S., at least, the government has come out with a statement against douche. And so now, though, the most famous U.S. company, Summer's Eve, which is the old not-so-fresh-feeling company, They've moved on to selling things like wipes and special soaps and things that they say are meant to be used for external use. However, they're marketing it by doing things like putting advertorials in magazines like Cosmo that say, 5 ways to ask for a raise. Step 1, douche. So, pack these feminine wipes to clean yourself up. I don't know what job they think that women are doing that they require that in order to ask for a raise. But again, we have a useless product that's being sold as a solution to women's confidence, like the confidence that is being damaged by the actual product. You know, no. Women would never have thought to think about how their vagina is before going in for a raise, now have that extra thought to think, and it's not pretty.
But that, my friend, is progress. You know, in the 50s, they didn't even mention jobs, so I guess that's
true. I mean, the sheer idea that a woman has access to an office bathroom where she can use her feminine wipes before going in to ask for a raise, that you're right, that is definitely equality.
You've come a long way, baby. How about the book The Secret?
It's another product that has been targeted more at women than men, but mostly through channels like Oprah. Oprah was the launching pad for The Secret. The idea is that whatever you want from the universe, all you have to do is act as though you already have it, and then the universe will magically give it to you, which at first blush may seem like a harmless sort of belief system. But when you look at the consequences of those beliefs, it's rather disturbing. I mean, it's victim blaming at its finest. Children with cancer, for instance, only have cancer because they just weren't wishing hard enough. And you actually do you see this happening to people who think that they can cure themselves of disease or they can work their way out of poverty, not by taking any direct action, but by simply wishing. And if they don't get, if the universe does not give them what they are wishing for, it's their fault. They didn't do it right. So maybe they should go pick up the sequel to The Secret, The Power, and learn more about how to use this bogus superpower that doesn't actually exist. So it actually discourages people from doing the things that we know can actually lead to positive action, things like planning the steps that it might take you to reach your goal and then focusing on each of those steps. That's one example of a way that people could actually accomplish the things that they would like to accomplish. It can also discourage someone from, say, seeing a doctor. If they think that they don't need to, that all they need to do is imagine themselves well, that could be a huge and deadly problem.
Another dangerous idea is right there in the title of your presentation, actually, women's intuition. So what's wrong with that?
The idea of women's intuition, again, at first blush, it doesn't seem like a huge problem. This idea that women have a special, mysterious, magical way of knowing that men don't have access to. And there are a lot of women, I think, who actually find empowerment in that idea. However, the problem comes from finding empowerment in something that doesn't actually exist. And in my talk, I go into some of the interesting studies that have been done on intuition. And the fact of the matter is, though, that no matter what, pretty much all the studies find that there is no such thing as women's intuition. It doesn't exist. So this comes to bear in situations like with Jenny McCarthy, who has for the past several years preached this idea of a mommy instinct, the idea that parents don't need to pay attention to what doctors or scientists tell them about their children. Jenny McCarthy says that mommies can just reach down deep inside and know exactly what to do for their kid. And what she's referring to there is the idea that vaccines cause autism. So what Jenny was preaching was this idea that don't get your kids vaccinated, even if doctors and scientists tell you that vaccines are safe and effective. You don't need to do that because you are a mommy. You can fight against what they're telling you because you know for a fact what's best for your kid. And what's best for your kid is not getting them vaccinated, leaving them open to disease, and then fighting that disease through a variety of alternative medicine, none of which actually works.
Honestly, that was the most sort of terrifying part of your presentation, because I'm a mother, and when I was pregnant, I read so many parenting books that my doctor actually basically had to pry them out of my hands to get me to calm down, because I wanted to know everything about the process, because I was very, very aware that I did not know. I certainly didn't have a mommy instinct that allowed me to just pull information from the ether. So in someone like McCarthy's view, does that mean I'm faulty? And how does that make other women feel who are aware of the fact that they don't have all the information?
That's the problem we face, is the idea of finding empowerment in a superpower that doesn't exist. What happens when you reach for that superpower and you find nothing there? You're right. For a lot of women, they'll feel like less than a woman. And in my talk, I mention a really great essay from the editor of About.com's autism page, in which she describes that exact feeling where she felt defective because she had a son who was autistic, and she saw Jenny McCarthy telling her that she should know exactly what to do because she's a mother. And all she could do was feel scared. You know, all she could do was do all the research she could, ask her doctors what they thought, trust in them, trust in their professional ability to help her son, and go with that. And so, yeah, she felt wrong. She felt defective. And so I feel very strongly that we need to focus on helping women find empowerment in things that actually exist. And it's why I try to promote the idea, not of women's intuition, but of women's reason, women's logic, the things that are actually the exact same as the things that men have. We do have the ability to think logically and to, for instance, pursue professions in the sciences, or even just to do research on things like vaccines and to come to a logical conclusion without relying on some weird supernatural force within us.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is Rebecca Watson, founder of the Skeptic.org blog network. We are talking about women and the pseudoscience that's marketed to us. So what other kinds of, let's call it not exactly evidence-based products and services are there that women are falling for?
Oh, man. Take your pick. Basically, anything you see on Oprah or saw on Oprah, she doesn't have a show anymore, thank goodness. But it's really infuriating because I think Oprah could have been, again, a figure of empowerment that women could look up to because her story is pretty remarkable. You know, she worked really hard to get where she's got to now. So it's a shame that she used her platform for so long to promote just the most idiotic ideas focused on women. So one example is the Oprah show's resident doctor, gynecologist, lady doctor, if you will, Christiane Northrup, would come on. And I have this amazing clip of Northrup teaching the audience how to direct energy toward, and I quote, the lower heart.
For real.
Yeah, yeah. They don't use words like vagina. You have to understand that's a grown-up, dirty word. So they use words like lower heart, vajayjay. She encourages health, women's health, by having Oprah's audience stand up and put one hand over their upper heart and one hand over their lower heart and just focus on sending energy to their vaginas. It's really quite disturbing to see so many women, you know, standing there basically trying to make themselves orgasm, I think. I'm not sure. So this is someone who's presented to the audience as a doctor who, you know, is focused on women's health, but she's just feeding them, you know, pseudoscience, the idea of directing energy to your vagina. That's not the way to promote health for your reproductive system. She teaches them to use pseudonyms instead of the actual terms for their genitals. It's infantilizing and fantasizing, but not in the fun way, in the manipulation of reality way. So it's really disturbing that this is what's presented to a very large audience of women as science.
I do have to say there are obviously pseudoscientific products that are marketed to men, right? I'm thinking that grow your penis once.
I'm working on an article right now. It's all about the pseudoscience of SkyMall. I love SkyMall. I fly a lot, so I read it obsessively. Just kind of sad, I guess. But I really like the baldness cures. They're on every other page, and each one is more ridiculous than the last. And my favorite are the ones that look like space helmets with rings of LEDs on them. And the copy is full of just jargon, and it doesn't actually explain how an LED is supposed to stimulate hair growth. And the thing is, I have no idea. Maybe somehow this works. I'm trying to keep an open mind. I'm going to be speaking to actual scientists to get the skinny on this. But I do feel for men in that regard because, again, advertisers have found a weakness. They've found some way they can make people feel insecure, and they have come up with products that supposedly solve that insecurity. As opposed to simply letting men feel some amount of security in the fact that they lose their hair. I mean, you'd think that that would be something they could find masculine because, you know, mostly it's just men who lose their hair. So you'd think they would be proud of that. That means they're the most masculine
right.
of men.
Right. You know? And this is, I think this is the problem for me is there's very specific gender-based vulnerabilities that marketers are targeting.
Marketers are in an interesting position in that they both reflect what's going on in our society, and they also feed back into it. So it's the same as we see with toy marketers, for instance, marketing the blue army doll to the boys and the pink princess to the girls, and they separate their aisles, you know, at Toys R Us or whatever. There's this giant pink aisle that's all girls, and this adventure aisle that's all boys. You know, this isn't something that toy marketers made up, but it's something that they take advantage of, and they reinforce these gender roles. And it's the same thing with pseudoscience. You know, they take advantage of those gender roles that we've already established, and they reinforce them. They continue to make women feel bad about themselves. To a lesser extent, I think they make men feel bad about themselves. There's a really great British sketch show called Mitchell and Webb, and they do this bit. It's a satire of marketing towards women, and there's an advertiser or a voiceover telling this woman that she's too fat, that she needs to cut her hair, she needs to put on makeup, and basically just breaking her down in order to sell her products. And then it switches to the male marketing, and it's just like, men, you're awesome. Have a beard and a shave. You know, and I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's true. If you watch ads, men, you know, win the day in the beer commercials. They win the beautiful woman who is just an object. You know, if you look at our advertising, even ads that are focused on women treat women so incredibly poorly that it's a wonder that we fall for it.
But at the end of the commercial, they always have a clean house.
That's true, thanks to the lady. That's the worst that men usually get it, is men are too stupid to clean the house. They're just giant children who are incapable of even the simplest adult task when it comes to house cleaning. And the woman is portrayed as competent. And that's the only thing that we can be competent at, apparently, is cleaning up after the men.
Well, do you think women, though, are especially vulnerable to insecurity-dependent marketing?
I think that they are. I think that things are unfortunately starting to even out a little bit.
By making everyone feel equally like crap?
Yeah, yeah. Yay. I think advertisers are starting to make men feel like crap. I think they are starting to objectify men more, but nowhere near the level of women as of right now. So yeah, I think that women are particularly susceptible to it. Women are seen as the ones who make the financial decisions. So, you know, a lot of things are targeted at them. And also, I think there's just this problem with, in general, with pseudoscience targeting women. Women, I think, are in general conditioned to go with the flow and to not stand up and to not say that's BS. Unfortunately, I think that women are conditioned to be nice and compassionate, and it prevents them sometimes from expressing their skepticism to the degree that men feel quite confident expressing their skepticism. And I think that's one of the reasons why, until recently, we weren't seeing a whole lot of criticism of this stuff. But I think that's turning around. I think that, you know, with blogs, with mouthy women sort of rising up right now, I think we are seeing a lot more interesting and insightful commentary that breaks down gendered marketing, especially as it pertains to preying upon women's insecurities.
Well, do continue to be a mouthy woman, Rebecca.
Thank you. You too, Desiree.
And very happy to have you here finally.
Yeah, it's been too long. I've been insulted up until this very point. So very glad you've been here. I hate you. I think every interview should end with anger directed towards the interviewer.
That's awesome.
You know what? Screw you guys. Screw you.
Awkward.
I'm kidding. I wasn't insulted. It's a joke. I love you. I love the show.
You can find Rebecca Watson at skeptchick.org or at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, why not click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, so that you can be the first to hear about show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the program, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and
witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our studio assistants are Helen Cavillion and Chelsea Butler. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.